My name is John Perrick, and I'm an alcoholic. And I just soon end it right there. Huh? before I go on, this is not notes, but these are for those senior moments I have with names. And so I don't forget to thank everyone. I'd like to thank Joe for asking me and calling me up to be of service, and Vicky, who was nice enough to talk to me on the phone and get me squared away. And Daryl and Dwayne for picking us up at the airport today, and Lori and the rest of the committee. Thank you so very much for all your kindness. I appreciate it. Put these in my pocket, and I'm back on my own now. All that sobriety is wonderful, and especially all that new sobriety. I love to see newcomers at meeting, and they're very important. You know, I was sharing with someone earlier today, I had a great opportunity to speak at a recovery house for 3 years in a row. And the second year I spoke at that recovery house, it taught me something. I've had so many miracles and so many good things happen to me when I was being of service, or I thought I was being of service, and good things happened to me. The second time I spoke at this recovery home called the McClay House in the San Fernando Valley, some girl was leading the meeting, was asked to lead the meeting, and when it came time for her to share her experience, strength, and hope, she stood up here at the microphone. She said, "I'm your leader for tonight, and I want to share my experience, strength. I'm supposed to share my experience, strength, and hope." She said, "But I got kicked out of the recovery house last week because I went back out for using." And she said, "And when I went back out, I went on a run, and I lost my job. So I don't have any experience, and I don't have any strength. And I came here tonight hoping to get hope." And she said, "Now I'd like to introduce our speaker, John from Granada Hills." And I was stunned. And I got up to the podium and I said, "I don't know why y'all came, but I came tonight to hear what she had to say to me. Because I have to remember that when people walk in this room as newcomers, and those 3-dayers and those 2-dayers and those 1-dayers, a lot of them here come here hoping to get hope because they have no hope. And it's up to me to always remember and not get complacent, to put out my hand, because for that I am responsible. And I never want to forget that. So, welcome to the newcomers." I first came around this program in 1973 in North Hollywood, Radford. March 26th of this year, I celebrated 15 years of sobriety. So if you add that up, it doesn't quite compute. I was one of those who needed to go out and do a little more research. And that I did. I was going to noon meetings every day when I first got sober. And you know that we hear, and it was read tonight in Chapter 5 by Ken.
No.
By what?
You're right.
Okay. I'm right. I thought you had senior moments with names. And it was read tonight, you know, about this disease being cunning, baffling, and powerful. And cunning, baffling, and powerful to me doesn't mean that my disease tells me, "Have a drink, John." Because that's not very cunning, baffling, and powerful. You know, that's pretty direct. And if it says, "Have a drink, John," I say, "Screw you," you know. But what it does to me is it makes me think that I have problems out there, that other people are more to blame, that situations aren't the way I want them to be, and that the job isn't going the way it's supposed to go. And it makes me say, "Geez, if only these people would change. If only I had a better job, if only I made more money, things would be a lot better. Poor, poor me. It was a lot better when I drank. Maybe I should have a drink." See, it makes me think that I want to drink, but that's my disease. Cunning, baffling, and powerful. Always there, always working. And so when I was going to those noon meetings at North Hollywood Radford, my disease started working in my head. And I had been taught in the beginning not to listen for the differences, to listen for the similarities, not to try to identify with all the stories, but identify with the feelings. And somewhere along the line, within that 6-month period of time, my disease made me forget that, or didn't want me to pay attention then to that, or didn't want me to do that. So I start hearing all these differences. And I heard about people who ended up in straitjackets, and I heard about people who drank, and my head said, John, you didn't do that. And I heard about people who had lost their wives, and my head said, John, you didn't do that. And I heard about people who drank wine out of a paper sack sitting on a curb or back in an alley, and my head, John, you didn't do that. So I came home one day, and I had the big book, and I said to my wife, who's here, and that was before she was an Al-Anon, I said to her, I said, you know, I've been going to those meetings, and I hear all these stories, and I might have a problem with alcohol, but these people are sick. Yeah. They're going to be a bad influence on me. So I'm intelligent enough, and I have this book, and I know how to read, so I'm going to read this book all by myself and stay sober. And I did. And I read that book for another 6 months, all by myself. And I stayed sober for another 6 months, which equaled a year. And on my first year of sobriety, instead of going back to North Hollywood Radford and taking my cake and first year candle, I went out and celebrated and had dinner and a bottle of wine. Strange thing happened, cunning, baffling, and powerful. I went out and had dinner and a bottle of wine. And I paid that tab, and as I walked out of that restaurant, what do you think my head said to me? John, you had a bottle of wine. Alcoholics can't have a bottle of wine. Maybe you're not an alcoholic, John. Maybe it went away. And at that time, the Rand Institute, God bless the Rand Institute, came out with a research, their research paper, and they said that they have found, and I'll paraphrase this because I don't remember the exact phraseology, but they said, we have found that some alcoholics, after a period of abstinence, can drink like normal people. That's me. So I decided, you know, but I'm going to take this slow. I just don't want to rush back into it because I could be an alcoholic. So I just played around a little bit. And I had a few drinks here and didn't have that craving, you know. Had a few drinks there. So I was managing Little League in Granada Hills, and I used to take our team to Dodger Stadium once a year on an event day, picture day or autograph day. And this particular year, it was picture day, and I took our 13 little kids down to Dodger Stadium, and it was like about 95 degrees and real temperature, but on the field with about 15 or 20,000 people taking pictures with all those kids, it was like about 120. And after pictures were over and it was time to get the kids back up in the stands, and I had a Coke, and that made me thirstier. And I looked around that stadium, and cunning, baffling, and powerful, in my alcoholic mind, I saw everyone at Dodger Stadium drinking beer and eating hot dogs. And my head said to me, John, you were an officer in the United States Army. You were in Vietnam. You lost your eye over there. And you did this, John, and you did that, John, and you did this, John, and you did that, John. Can't you have a drink, John? You're only 33 years old, John. Aren't you a man? Men drink. And I said to my wife, excuse me, I'll be right back. And I went up to the snack bar, and I came back with 2 cups of beer. And with those pre-Al-Anon look of death eyes, she said to me, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I'm at a baseball game, and I'm going to drink beer and eat hot dogs." And from that moment on, I never slipped. I don't think I've ever slipped at anything in my life. And some people say they slip, and I believe that. But for me, I didn't slip. I made a conscious decision that day that that sobriety sucked and that I would rather drink. And I went out. And that's the way it was. You know, and I went out for 11 years. And in that 11 years, it got worse. And I almost killed myself. And I reached one point in my sobriety, in my alcoholism, when I was down to 145 pounds, and I was turning yellow, and everybody said, "God, is something wrong with you?" And I said, "No, I'm fine." And I didn't see it. And you know what? I didn't get sober then. It was 2 years later. You know. But I should have known there was a lot of difference. You know, Darlene and I, this is my wife, Darlene. She's 22 years in Al-Anon. You know, yeah. And I say 22 years in Al-Anon because when I first went to North Hollywood Radford and got sober for that first year, I wanted her to go to Al-Anon to participate in my sobriety. And she didn't. And that upset me. And when I went back out, she went to Al-Anon on her own. And that really upset me. And then she got my kids involved in Al-Anon, my son first. And I went berserk on that. So see, because my idea of Al-Anon was they were going to take my son and fill him with all this stuff about alcoholics so that when Al-Anon taught Darlene how she should leave me and how to get the divorce, Al-Anon would have taught my kid to choose to go with his mother. And this whole thing was a conspiracy. And that was my idea. But it didn't work out. But I should have known something was different. You know, when I met Darlene, she was doing postgraduate work at the University of Santa Barbara. And I happened to be working on Sunset Strip as a bartender. And I was also doing some acting, and I was acting in a play, and that particular night I wasn't bartending. I had just finished doing a thing and came to the bar for a couple of drinks only. And there was a friend of mine sitting there, and there was Darlene and her girlfriend who was just seeing the sights before going back up to Santa Barbara. And this friend of mine said, "John, see these two girls here?" He said, "I'm trying to hit on this one." He said, "Why don't you talk to the other one so mine doesn't leave if the other one wants to leave, you know?" I said, "No, Bob, I'm really tired. I just want to have a couple of drinks and go home, you know." So I had a couple of drinks, and then I thought, well, I'll just have one more. And I'll just have one more. And then I started talking to Darlene. I said, "All right, hi. My name's John. What's yours?" Six weeks later, we were married. They said it would never last. This August, we'll celebrate 35 years of sobriety. I mean, of marriage. And thank God it happened the way it happened, and that I was the alcoholic and she was the Al-Anon. Because of her program and her strong belief in the principles and her practicing the 12 steps, never once asking me once I went back out to go back to AA and just practicing her own program, it saved my life. And by her working her own program in Al-Anon, I began to want what she had. And I went back to AA on my own. You see, but when we first met, and got married, we would go out to drink, and party. And so she would drink with me, and I should have known something was different from, me being bodily different then, but I couldn't compute it all. I just thought she was kind of a lightweight. We'd go out to dinner. And I'd say, I'd have scotch and tall scotch and water, and she would drink bourbon and seven. And I couldn't stand bourbon and seven. This is that 7-Up. You know. That's what made me sick in the morning. So she'd have a bourbon and seven, and I'd have a tall scotch and water. I'd drink my bourbon and seven, and she'd take a sip off her scotch. I drink my scotch and water, she'd take a sip off her bourbon and seven. I'd order another scotch and water, she'd take another sip off her bourbon and seven. Dinner would come, and I'd order a bottle of wine. I'd drink the bottle of wine, and she'd take a sip off her bourbon and seven. Dinner was over, and I'd have a cabassier. And she'd take a sip off her bourbon and seven. I'd have another cabassier. And she'd take another sip off her bourbon and seven. And I'd pay the check. And we'd be getting ready to leave, and there would be that much bourbon and seven left. And even though I didn't like that 7-Up, I'd say, you're going to leave that? She'd say, yeah. I said, bet me. And I'd finish her drink. Something's different. You know. And I love the Big Book. I really do. And I read the Big Book a lot, and I study the Big Book a lot. And the people I sponsor come over to my house once a week, and we read the Big Book, and we study the Big Book. And I have, for me, I have to make that Big Book come alive, and I have to personalize that Big Book. And over the years, I had to personalize a lot of things to make that, to believe everything in that Big Book is true for me. And when I first read the doctor's opinion, it says what makes us a little different and makes the alcoholic physically and mentally different, and one of the things that happens is the phenomena of craving. I like that word, that phrase, the phenomena of craving. So dramatic. So dramatic that I said, I never had the phenomena of craving. What is that? You know, I just want a drink. You know? The phenomena of craving. I never walked into the bar and said to the bartender, give me a tall scotch and a soda. I got the phenomena of craving. So I've got to believe this Big Book, though. So how does the phenomena of craving manifest itself into me? And I started to think about my drinking. And Darlene and I would go out to a bar, and I'd have my scotch and water, and she'd have her bourbon and seven. And I'd have another scotch and water, and she'd have a sip off her bourbon and seven. She'd say, you ready to leave? And I'd say, yeah, in a minute, I just want one more. She'd say, okay. And I'd have one more, and I'd see somebody I know, and I'd buy them a drink because I know they're going to buy me one back. I just have one more, right? And we'd have that, and then she would say, you ready to leave? And I'd say, yeah, just one more. And we'd have one more. And then she'd ask me, you ready to leave now? And I'd say, and then I would say, and I'd look at her and say, no, I'm not ready to leave. If you want to leave, take the car and get the hell out of here. I'm going to stay here and drink. And I'll get home and I'll take a cab. Don't ask me if I want to go. That's the phenomena of craving with John. It manifested itself by saying, just one more. Just one more. You know. Cunning, baffling, and powerful. It keeps trying to disguise itself. That's why it's cunning, baffling, and powerful. As you can tell, when I drank, something happened. I never hit Darlene in anger. I never hit my kids in anger. I spanked them as a father. Well, that's when spanking was allowed. Can't do that anymore. But I hit everything else, you know. I broke doors and I broke windows. And dinner plates went off the table. And, you know, our wall had enough that if somebody came over and they were hungry, they'd just lick the wall off. And that's the way it went. That's the way it went. And as I said, Darlene went back. I went to Al-Anon on her own. And when she went back to Al-Anon, she would come home from a meeting, and as I said, I was angry that she went to Al-Anon. And I would be at the kitchen table, drunk, totally out of my mind and deride her for going to Al-Anon. And I said, you think you know the steps? What do you know about these steps? I study this big book. I'll tell you what the steps are. And how I quote the steps to her. Because I need this program. Drunk. But you know, recovery is cunning, baffling, and powerful. But because I knew those steps, and because I wasn't doing those steps, didn't mean those steps were lying dormant. They were back in there. So that 11 years later, when I needed to go back, and I wanted to go back, and I did go back, I knew where to go because I knew those steps. But I would, as I said, deride her for doing that. And then over these 11 years, changes began to happen. You know, at first, like I said, Al-Anon was there trying to get her to teach her how to get me to stop drinking. And I said, I'll show you. You know, I drank more. And so I would disappear for, there was a 3-year period when I would disappear for 10 days, come home for 2, disappear for 7 days, come home for 1, disappear for over 3 years, you know. And thank God, as I said, that she was the Al-Anon and I was the alcoholic, because had it been reversed, I don't think I would have had the strong program that she had, and I would have kicked her out. But because she didn't kick me out, it ended up saving my life. But after I got over her, my resentment about her going back to Al-Anon, she began to practice her her program, and she began to detach. I like this, detach. You know. So she detached so much that she never made a run to the liquor store for me, but if she was going shopping at Vaughn's, she'd say, is there something you'd like? And I'd say, well, yeah, would you give me a 12-pack of beer? And she'd say, sure. Oh, yeah, I like this. So she would bring home a 12-pack of beer, you know. She detached. Okay. Then after a while, I began to resent that. She doesn't care if I kill myself. It's her way of killing me. And, you know, and then I began over the years noticing changes in her. I noticed how the difference in how she reacted to me. I noticed how her relationship with our friends changed, her relationship with our children changed. And it was all legitimate. And then I saw her develop this relationship. We had gone to church together a lot of times before, but I saw her develop a relationship with a power greater than herself, this higher power that I never saw before. And I saw this glow and this love and this joy in her face. And I began to want what she had. And what really did it, it's like when I would be gone for 10 days and I would come home, you know, over a 3-year period, when you're gone for 10 days and come home for 1 and gone for 2 weeks and come home for 1 day, and you do this all the time, and I'm a bar drinker, I can't stand up here and say I was chaste. You know, I was very unfaithful. So when I came home, I was guilty. So in order to get rid of my guilt, I had to start yelling at her. And find fault with her, and pick on her, and yell and scream and break things. So this one day, and she had a lot of program now, this one, and I used to love it, you know, when she used to yell back. Because you could never top an alcoholic. You know, and I could always say, and if intellectually she topped me, you know, I could always throw a chair through a window. That would stop that. You know. So this one day I came home, and I'm following her around the house, and I'm chipping over her shoulder, and she's not answering back. And our washer and dryer is out in the garage, and she was washing clothes that day. And I'm following her out there, and I follow her out to the garage, and I'm da 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 da. And she finally gets to the garage, and she turns around, she looks at me, and I accused her of something, which I don't even remember what it was. And she looked at me, and she said, "A great Al-Anon line, and if there are any Al-Anons in here, please use that line if you're alcoholic still drinking," because it got my attention. She looked at me, and she said, "You may be right." I didn't know where to go. I said, "You're damn right, I'm right." I knew she had changed, that this change was legitimate, and that got my attention. The last night, I drank. I went out with a hooker. Came home drunk. Darlene didn't say anything. She went to work. The kids went to school. And I sat on the couch. And it was like my moment of clarity. And it was like all of a sudden my whole life began to pass before me. And I said, "Well, John, what happened to that officer in the United States Army with all that stuff he used to wear? What happened to that actor? And what happened to this? What happened to that? You know, you turned into a piece of nothing. You know, what are you doing? What are you doing to this woman who loves you and to these children?" And I started to cry. And I always had some kind of God in my life. And I had to ask God for help a lot of times, but always with a condition. "Hey, God, if you get me out of this, I'll never do this again. And if you do that, I'll never do this again." And God would do his thing, and then I'd forget my condition. But that morning, when I had this moment of clarity, for the first time, I said that alcoholic prayer and didn't even know it was an alcoholic prayer. I said, "God, please help me. I can't do this anymore." And there was no condition. And for some strange reason, I got up off the couch, walked into the kitchen, got the phone book out, called central office in the valley, got a drunk by the name of Leo Sullivan, who I'm not breaking his anonymity because that's where he shares, and we've talked about this, and he knows how I share. And I got Leo, and he talked to me until it was time to go to a meeting, a 6 o'clock meeting at the Valley Club in the San Fernando Valley. And we talked for about 2 hours, and he knew I had been on the program before because I had told him that. And after 2 hours, he said, "John," he said, "there's a 6 o'clock meeting at the Valley Club." He said, "I want you to go." And I said, "Yes, okay." And he said, "Are you dressed?" And I said, "Yes, I am." And he said, "Do you have your shoes on?" And I said, "Yes, I do." And he says, "Is your car in the parking, in your driveway?" And I said, "Yes, it is." And he said, "When we hang up, promise me one thing." And I said, "What's that, Leo?" And he said, "You won't think about what we said, what we talked about." He said, "You'll just hang up this phone and automatically walk out, get in the car, turn the key, and drive to the Valley Club. Can you do that?" And I said, "Yes, I can." And I did that. First time I took direction, I didn't know I was taking direction. And I walked out, got in the car, drove to the Valley Club. That was March 26, 1986, and I've been sober ever since. I walked into the Valley Club surrendered, but it didn't make it easy. You see, because I had a lot of years and a lot of booze and a lot of dope, and I never went to a detox place. I never went to a hospital. I never went to a recovery house. I detoxed at the tables at the Valley Club, and it wasn't easy. But y'all told me to go to any lengths, and that's what I did. And so I would go to the noon meeting, and after the noon meeting, I'd be afraid to drive home because there were a lot of bars between that Valley Club and where I lived. And y'all told me to go to any lengths. And I said, "What about work?" And they said, "Did you care about work when you were out there drinking?" And I said, "No." And they said, "Don't care about it now." And so I stayed at that clubhouse for the 6 o'clock meeting. And after the 6 o'clock meeting, I was afraid to drive home, so I stayed for the 8:30 meeting. And after that meeting, I stayed in the little clubhouse closed, and then I drove home. And I did that for about the first 3 or 4 weeks of my sobriety until I felt enough nerve to drive home after a noon meeting, you know. And during that time, there was an old timer, and like I said, I always had a belief in some kind of higher power, but I always got kind of upset with that higher power, and I was brought up Catholic, and for that didn't work, and so then I studied Zen, and I studied mysticism, and I studied Kundalini, and I studied Tantra, and I was looking for some kind of relationship with some kind of power greater than myself. But whatever gods that I ever found, people would always tell me what that god looked like, where that god lived, what that god expected of me, and what that god would do to me if I didn't do what he expected me to do. And I walked in here, and we were the first fellowship that granted me the dignity to have a god of my understanding. And so, in those first couple of weeks of sobriety, there was an old-timer who got up on the podium, and he couldn't speak very good English, had very bad diction. And he said, when alcoholics first are new and they come in here, we realize that some of you don't have too strong of a belief in a God because you tried God and it didn't work for you. But the belief in a higher power is vital in recovery here in AA. So,
we don't,
you know, tell you what to believe in, but please have some kind of higher power. And if that's difficult for you, we understand that. And if you don't have a concept of a God right now, believe that I believe. And he said, if you can't do that, he said, make the group your higher power. And he said, and if you can't do that, in this Valley Club, there were poles going down the center. And he said, make that pole your higher power. I caught the resentment. I'm brand new, but I know more than this guy. I had studied all these disciplines of religion. And here's some old-timer telling me to make a pole my higher power. Bet me. So I didn't like him and I didn't like his pole. About 2 days later, I walked into the Valley Club before the noon meeting and I was in a very bad way. A very bad way. And I went in to get a cup of coffee and the only person in the little coffee room was the girl serving coffee and I didn't want to talk to her because she didn't have enough wisdom for me. I was waiting for someone important to come in. So I walked out to the meeting area, and nobody came in. And I looked at that door, and I'm shaking and everything, and I said, I know how to stop this shaking and shit. I know what to do. And I looked at that door, and for some reason, I looked at the door, and I looked at that pole. I looked at the door and I looked at the pole again. And I sat down next to the pole. People started filtering in and I stayed for the noon meeting and after the noon meeting was over I felt better. I stayed for the 6 o'clock meeting, I sat next to the pole again. And I stayed the 8:30 meeting and I sat next to the pole again. And I sat next to the pole for about 2 weeks. And after about 2 weeks, I'm sitting next to the pole, and it's like I knew, like my higher power was talking to me, and in my head came like, you know, it's John. I don't have an ego, John. You do. If you want me to be in a pole, I'll be in a pole. If you want me to be in a tree, I'll be in a tree, because I'm everywhere, John. All I want to do is help you. You know, drop your ego. And then I began to develop my relationship with my higher power. And then I found my sponsor. I found my sponsor through resentment. Because after about 2 months, I had all this wisdom. And I was at a Monday night spiritual meeting, and I raised my hand to share because I had all this good stuff to say. And there was some old-timer there, and he raised his hand, and in my mind, he put me down. And I was immediately back in a bar mentality. When he put me down, I looked at him. And I'm looking at him, I'm staring at him, and I want him to look at me, just like I did it with people in a bar when they upset me. I look at him and say something. So I was looking at this old-timer, and he never looked at me for the entire meeting. So the meeting was over, and I got upset, and he went in the coffee room, and I followed him in there. And here was this guy who wasn't my sponsor at the time, and he saw me follow this old-timer in there, and he said, "Hi, my name's Tom." I said, "Hi, my name's John." He said, "You're a newcomer, huh?" I said, "How'd you know that?" He said, "Well," he said, "you look full strain." I said, "Yeah." So we began to talk. And we talked until the clubhouse closed, and we talked for a long time. And we got kicked out, and we went outside in the parking lot, and we talked till 2 a.m. And I did this for about 3 weeks, and after we were in the parking lot, I said, for about the third time at 2:00 a.m, I said, "Tom, will you be my sponsor?" And he said, "Yes." And I was at his house every Monday night for the first 5 years of my sobriety. And the only reason why I'm not at his house still every Monday night is he moved up to Porterville, and we still keep in touch. My sponsor taught me a lot of things. And that's where I learned how to work these steps, along with the fellowship. But we talked many, many hours. And one of the things that he taught me was one of my favorite lines in the big book, which was read tonight. "Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely." And I told my sponsor, "Man, that's a great line. I love that. Because, you know, I can't even admit that I'm an alcoholic with my old ideas, because my old ideas say, 'John, you're not an alcoholic.' There's a difference. Alcoholics need to drink. You don't need to drink. You like to drink. You know, it's my old ideas." So I said, "I have to get rid of my old ideas. I like that, Tom." And he said, "What old ideas do you think you have to get rid of?" And I gave him all my bad old ideas. And he says, "That's great, John." He said, "Read that line again." And I read the line again. "Some of us have tried to hold on our old ideas, and the result was no, until we let go absolutely." And he said, "What ideas now?" And I told him my ideas, and they were all bad old ideas. And he said, "Read that line again." I said, "No, Tom, what are you doing to me? You read the line, you know." And he said, "Where does it say bad old ideas?" It says, "All my old ideas." I said, "My good ones too?" And he said, "Yeah, your good ones too." I still had my ego, and I said, "Tom, some of my old ideas, my old good ideas, are better than some people's new good ideas." And being a good sponsor, he never said no. He said, "You may be right." He said, "But let me tell you something. If you don't get rid of those old good ideas, they'll never get any better, because you've accepted them. And if you have this great old idea about love, your concept of love will never grow, because you've accepted your old good idea, John." And I had to learn to get rid of all my good ideas. He taught me that I had two emotions, fear and love, and everything else is a reaction to those emotions. And how he taught me that was all the simple things. Like he said, "Tell me about your day today, and don't tell me all the dramatic stuff. Tell me all the simple stuff, like driving on the freeway." And I said, "Oh, okay." Well, I was driving on the freeway coming home, and there was this guy, and he cut me off. And he said, "What'd you do?" And I said, "Oh, he cut me off, so I drove up and gave him the finger." He said, "Really?" He said, "What were you afraid of?" I said, "Did you hear what I just said, Tom? I'm driving down the freeway. This guy's driving like an idiot. He cut me off, so I gave him the finger. That's it." He said, "What were you afraid of?" I said, "Are we talking about the same stuff you're talking about? Let me tell you this story slower, Tom. I'm driving down the freeway, and this guy cut me off, and I give him fingers." And he said, "Let me talk slower, John. What were you?" I said, "Okay, I'm tired of your intellectual game. Tell me." And he said, "Well, I can't tell you." He said, "But let me give you some questions that you could answer. Were you afraid, number one, that you were going to get in an accident?" I said, "Well, yeah, briefly. You know, but that passed." He said, "Were you afraid that you weren't going to be macho? Show him?" "Well, that you weren't going to be a man?"
You gotta be bigger. He was taking your spot on the freeway. Were you afraid he was taking your spot?
Well, kinda.
I said, oh, I see. I did have some kind of fear, huh? He said, yeah, you had some kind of fear, John. Even if it was afraid that you weren't going to be macho. Yeah. And I began to analyze my reactions in the terms of fear and came to believe my sponsor that I only have two emotions, love and fear. And if I'm not in the love, I'm in the fear. And that anger is a reaction to my fear. You know, the big book tells us that staying sober is just not enough. A greater demonstration of our principles comes about in our homes, our jobs, and our other affairs. Homes comes first. So I had to learn to practice these principles at home. One of the things that really used to irritate me about Darlene, she's a great housekeeper. She still is. But every time she would clean the house, she'd have this bucket of water that she would leave in the kitchen. Just leave it there. And the whole house was clean. I'd come home, and especially when I was drinking, you know, I'd hit that bucket and the water would go on. I said, you and your damn bucket, you didn't put it there, I wouldn't have knocked it over. Yeah. So we used to have a lot, I'd yell and scream about that bucket. So anyway, I get sober and I'm going through these sessions with my sponsor and I come home and there's that bucket. And I immediately get angry. And she's still leaving this bucket here. And I tell her, how could you be such a good housekeeper and leave a bucket of dirty water here? I came home one day and I remember what my sponsor said. You know, you get angry, you're in the fear. I looked at this bucket and I said, why am I afraid of a bucket? I don't understand. I said, think about it the way your sponsor told you to think about it, John. I said, okay, it's a bucket. What are you afraid of? Well, I don't know. Does the bucket bother you? Yes. Empty it. Wait a minute. Wait a minute. I can't empty the bucket? Why? Because Darlene put it there. Well, empty the bucket, John. It's bothering you. It's not bothering her. Empty the bucket. I can't. Why? Because she put it there. What are you afraid of, John? I'm afraid of a program of rigorous honesty. The theme of this convention, to thy own self be true. Well, if I empty that bucket, not kind of like this manly figure at home. Drop the manly figure, empty the bucket, John. But okay, and, wow, there's an and. Yes, John, what is your, and you empty this bucket unconditionally. Oh, meaning that when she comes home, I can't say there was your bucket there, but I emptied it for you. And I said, no, you can't say that, John. Empty the bucket. So I emptied the bucket. And I didn't say anything. And the following week, the bucket was there, and I emptied the bucket again. And I didn't say anything, and she didn't say anything. And I'm waiting for her to say something. She didn't. But I practiced my program on a bucket. And you know what? Today, I don't know whether she leaves that bucket there or not, because I don't even look. It's not that important anymore. You know? She could leave the bucket there on Saturday, I wouldn't know it. Not in my mind anymore. See, certain things don't make me angry anymore, not because I'm such a great guy, because my thinking has changed in a lot of areas. And that's what the program has taught me to do, you know. And I've lived these steps, and that's what I have to do on a daily basis, one day at a time, to the best of my ability, some days better than others, you know. The working, you know, I sometimes, when I learn these steps, I have to learn them intellectually.
because I had no other basis to do it. So I learned these steps one at a time, 1 through 12, intellectually. And then after that, I had to kind of integrate them in my mind and work them kind of psychologically. And then, for me today, you know, they're second nature, and I work these steps when I need to work them. Sometimes I get, scares me, for me, when I hear people, when those steps are on the wall. Now, don't get me wrong, I like those steps on the wall because it reminds us all about those steps, but I don't want to work those steps off the wall because there's no instructions. You know, the instructions are in the big book. And if I work those steps off the wall, I have nothing but an off-the-wall program. You know. I can't do that. You know. But it's working these steps one day at a time to the best of my ability. You know how I like to equate that for myself? It's like some buddy wanting to be an apprentice in the carpenters union. And they start out and they know nothing. And so they're taught all the simple little tools. They're taught how to use a tape measure, and they're taught how to use a square, and how to use a handsaw and a coping saw. And then as they get a little sophisticated and more familiar with that, they're getting more tools, and they go into power tools and routers and table saws and joiners and planers and all that great stuff. And then they get more sophisticated, and they do that. And they learn all these tools one at a time through all the great tools, you know. And that's what I do with my steps. I learn them one at a time from step 1 to step 12. But you know what? When that carpenter's finished and that apprentice becomes a journeyman, he goes on the job, and he does the good job, and he doesn't just then, because he's a journeyman, use all those sophisticated power tools, because the first day he goes out to do something, he has to use his tape measure and measure something, use that simple little tool. And then he might use a power saw, then he might go back to another pair of pliers or something, you know. And that's the way my steps work for me, you know. Some days I have to go in all those directions and use whatever steps I need for my job that day. You know, one day at a time. I start every morning out by saying my third step prayer and a gratitude list. And that's very important for me. May not be for you, but it's very important for me. I have to say a gratitude list every morning. And, you know, I'll tell you one story, too, about the simple wisdom of a sponsor. I was about 9 months sober, and I'm going to my sponsor's house, as I said, every Monday night, and my sponsor has me in service. I'm going to 3 meetings a day, and I'm driving down the freeway coming home, and I have the radio on, and the Eagles come on the radio. Well, the Eagles were one of my great doping and tricking groups. And immediately, my head, my disease, takes me back to partying. And it takes me back to partying and with whom I was partying with. And I wanted to go and buy some booze, and I wanted to call this person up, and I wanted to have this thing. And I suddenly, you know, said, "Wow, John, what are you doing?" You know? So I drove home, and I had enough program to call my sponsor. And I said, "Tom, I was just driving down the freeway. What's wrong?" He said, "What do you mean, what's wrong?" I said, "I'm afraid." And he said, "About what?" And I said, "I'm at your house every Monday night. I'm going to 3 meetings a night, 3 meetings a day, and you got me in service. And I'm driving home, and I got the radio on, and the Eagles come on, and I want to drink. Why?" And he said, "Why?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Because you're an alcoholic, John." That's why we're alcoholic. I said, "Well, I never thought of that." I said, "What do I do if that happens again?" He said, "Change the station." I said, "Wow, man." Anyway, I said I got my sponsor out of resentment in this chat, you know. As I got a little bit more recovered, we used to go to the San Fernando convention every year, and there was this Chet. And he showed up, and I saw him there at this one convention. I said, "Darling," I said, "there's Chet. You know that story I told you about Chet?" I said, "That's him." I said, "You know what?" And I got a great sponsor, and great things have happened to me. And he was just one of God's actors playing this play, so that I could meet my sponsor. So I owe him an amend and a thank you. And I said, "Before the convention's over, I'm going to make this amend." And she said, "Okay." And the convention came and went, and I never made the amend. So the next year, there was Chet, and there we were. And I said, "You know, there's that Chet. I owe him an amend." And she said, "Yeah, I know." I said, "Before the convention's over, I'll make an amend." She said, "Okay." The convention came and went, and I never made the amend. Third year, there's Chet. Here we are. After about the eighth year, Darlene said to me, "There's that check you owe him in a minute." Right. So as it happened that year, she was on the Al-Anon committee, and so we didn't get into the banquet on time. And so when we got into the banquet, everybody was already seated. We had our little table numbers, and there were two empty chairs at this table, and guess who was sitting at this table? And I said, even my higher power is tired of me. So I sat down and I said, "Hi, Chet, my name's John and I owe you an amend." And he looked at me and he started laughing. He said, "What do you owe me?" I said, "Why are you laughing?" He says, "This is the greatest convention I've ever been to." I said, "Really?" And he said, "Yeah, eight people made an amend to me." I said, "All right." So I told him why I made an amend. He said, "No, I don't even remember that." Selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our problems. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us, seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find that sometime in the past we've made decisions based on self, which later placed us in the position to be hurt. So basically, we think our troubles are of our own making. And the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. Self-will, self-centeredness. I thought I was making that amend to Chet for me. But my higher power didn't want me to make that amend, and my higher power arranged that amend to be made when it was good, not only for John, but when it was also good for John and Chet. Because Chet said to me, laughingly, "That's the best convention. This is the best convention I've been to. Eight people made an amend to me." Because the following year, Chet died. So my higher power, our higher power, worked it out for everybody, not just for John. And John works on his ego. I used to work on my humility. And you know what? After working on my humility very, very hard, I came home one day and I was extremely proud of how humble I had been there. I said, "I must not be doing this right." And I found that to work on my humility, if I work the steps keep me humble one day at a time. You know, and if I work with other alcoholics, you know, if I listen to other people share, if I work with newcomers, things will take care of themselves. We've all been, those of us who've been around, have been to a lot of meetings, in a lot of places, in a lot of towns, and we've heard a lot of things. Most of which we don't hear that's new anymore. Sometimes somebody says it a little different and then it sinks in and you say, "Oh, wow," you know, more will be revealed, you know. But you know what? I need these meetings and I need to come back to them because I mentioned baseball earlier when I was speaking, and I love baseball. And to show you how sick I am, I'm still a Cub fan. And the only time I go to Dodger Stadium is when the Cubs are in town. And I like to get to Dodger Stadium before, you know, when the teams are out there practicing, you know, batting practice and fielding practice and so on and so forth. And I go there, and here are my stupid Cubs, and they're up there, out there practicing, and everybody's hitting home runs. Boom, man. And the Dodgers get up, and they're taking bangs. Everybody's hitting home runs. All these balls are going out of the park, you know, and guys are out in the outfield, and they're catching balls with no gloves on. Guy at third base, wow, man, no glove on. Throws it in, you know. The game starts, nobody gets a hit. Or they get a few hits, you know, but there's not many home runs and all that. You know, and that's kind of like how I look at my program today. You know, I need these meetings on a daily basis. Or on a regular basis, because these meetings are my batting practice. And it's easy for me to come in here and speak, and it's easy for me to sound great, you know, and look good. And I could hit a lot of home runs. But out there is where the game is played. That's where the game is played. And I don't always hit home runs out there, you know. But by coming to batting practice on a regular basis, it makes me a better hitter out there. And for that, I'm grateful. You know. I'll close with this. This program, a lot of miracles have occurred on this program for me. Our son got married on this program.
I was at the wedding and I remembered it. I didn't embarrass anybody. Our daughter got married on this program. I was at the wedding. Remembered it. As a matter of fact, I'll tell one other short story. When our daughter got married, I was 12 years sober. And our son-in-law's side of the family, they're normies, you know. Or some of them drink, and I, you know, it's none of my business. And I said to my daughter, you know, Cal, we're having this big wedding, and we're the parents of the bride, and I'm not going to punish Dave's side of the family by saying you can't have alcohol, you know. It's my daughter's wedding, and, you know, and it's his wedding, too, my son-in-law's wedding. So I said, we're going to have an open bar for those who drink, and all our friends are Al-Anons and AAs and Alakings, and I said, so we're going to have our own little thing. And we talked to the guy at the restaurant, and I said, I want it like a convention. The guy said, well, Darlene and I are talking, you know. I said, yeah, we want this table set up here with two coffee urns and this, you know, pitchers of water, and don't ever let that coffee run dry. And it was August. And the guy looked at me and said, well, you only need like a pot or so. It's August. It's hot. You know, I said, don't let that coffee run dry. And he said, well, you won't either. I said, yes, I will. And he said, no, you won't. I've been doing this for a long time. I said, believe me. I've been doing this for a lot longer. So we had that, you know, and there are a lot of AAs and Al-Anons, and Alakine showed up, and then was Dave's side of the family, and they drank, and, you know, we had our coffee and our water and da-da-da-da-da. And after the evening was over and we were paying the bill, the banquet manager and the owner comes up, and he said, you know, I really wouldn't have believed you guys would have gone through four urns of coffee. Well, you know. So he gave me the bar bill. I'm 12 years sober. And the bar bill was $5,000. And I started laughing. And Darlene says, why are you laughing? I said, it took me 12 years of sobriety to have the biggest bar bill in my entire life. And I'm sober. And I said, and I'm grateful. And she said, well, are you grateful? I said that all the AAs here weren't the ones that were drinking. We saved some money. This has been a beautiful trip. You know, the path to sobriety. I told you I used to deride Darlene for going to Al-Anon meetings, and the first time she went to a San Fernando AA Al-Anon convention, I was still drinking and using them, and I derided her about that, and I yelled and screamed about that, and she went anyway. And I was about 6 years sober, and we were asked to speak as a family, both our son and daughter and Darlene and I, in what they called the garden room, which was on the top of the Sheridan Universal. And we were sitting up at the main table, and there were windows down here, and it looked all over the San Fernando Valley. And the meeting hadn't started yet. You know, it was like before the meeting, and we sat there, and I started to cry. And Dustin said, why are you crying? And I said, it's the miracle of the program. And I changed my concept, my old ideas about miracles. I said, because to me, a miracle today is not the burning bush and the parting of the Red Sea. A miracle to me is something that has come to pass in my life that at one time was impossible. And here I was deriding you and making fun of you for coming to this meeting, to this convention. And I said, and it was impossible at that time to think that I would be here with you and our children sharing and speaking about recovery. Thank you, and I love you. And she said, thank you. And that was before the meeting. So a lot of miracles have happened, and I'll close with this. The greatest miracle is, you know, this fellowship. It started out, you know, over a kitchen table in Akron, Ohio by two drunks. And I have to remind myself that they were drunks, you know, because since I never met them, and I'd like to think they were historical figures and blow them out of proportion, they were drunks. You know, they drank like me, and they, you know, they threw up like I did. And they spent money that they didn't have like I did. And Bill cheated on them. His story. And But you know what? And that fellowship from that kitchen table grew, and it grew across this country, and it grew across this great world of ours. And there are meetings all over the world tonight. You know? And tonight, for me, this drunk John Perrick, you know, there are meetings going on all over the United States. But for me, this drunk, all of you are the fellowship. All of you tonight represent Alcoholics Anonymous in my life. All of you tonight represent God's will working in my life. All of you, by being here and my being here with you, are helping to keep me sober one more night. And for that, I could truly say, I love you. Thanks for letting me share.